The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning to everybody. I am Horacio Grigera-Naon, Director of the International Commercial Arbitration Program at the Washington College of Law, and I am very happy to welcome you to this joint undertaking of our program and the Inter-American Bar Association, this seminar on international commercial arbitration in the Americas. I would like to draw your attention first to our scheduled activities at our program for 2009. In May 2009, we will hold our traditional summer session. We will offer 5 courses on international commercial arbitration for credit and also open to practitioners on different areas, from nuts and bolts in international commercial arbitration to choice of law and evidentiary issues. In October, we will have also our traditional mock seminar, a 4-day seminar under the joint sponsorship of the American Arbitration Association, the International Chamber of Commerce, and ICSID. This year, the mock will be held under the rules of arbitration of ICSID. It will concern a foreign investment arbitration dispute. In early November, we will hold our annual lecture. As you possibly know, every year we hold an annual lecture. We invite a personality in the world of international arbitration to share his or her views on current developments. We started with Jerry Axon. Then we had Julian Liu, Sir Vivian Ramsey, and our speaker this year will be Jan Paulson. But I would ask you to check regularly our website for further or other information. The only limitation to what we do in the International Arbitration Program of the Washington College of Law is what is going on in the field of arbitration and of imagining ways of analyzing new trends and finding tools that would allow us to analyze those trends and eventually facilitate their understanding. It is true that our focus today is arbitration in the Americas. This is a part of the world of particular interest, in part because Latin America has a history of antipathy vis-à-vis arbitration. But at the same time, it has showed a shift towards a much more favorable and open attitude in the early 90s, to be followed, however, for what seems now, in certain countries and certain areas, a retreat from that positive orientation. On the other hand, because of its importance as an international arbitration center, developments in the area of international commercial arbitration in North America, and particularly in this country, have worldwide repercussions and require being closely followed. And to explore these aspects, we have, as you will see, a very distinguished group of experts that will give us an update of what's going on in the region in that respect. Without further ado, I have the great honor and pleasure to introduce to you my dear colleague, John Rooney, Jr., a partner at the Miami office of Schatz & Bowen, an experienced arbitrator, and also the chair of the International Arbitration Law Committee of the Inter-American Bar Association. Mr. Rooney is representing the other institution who is working with us on this seminar today. John.
Horacio, thank you very much. I'll be very brief and would like to start, first of all, by expressing our appreciation for this opportunity to co-sponsor this event with the Washington College of Law, which is our second year doing so. Just a few words about the Inter-American Bar, what we're about, and some activities that we have planned. And of course, it's almost obligatory today to begin by stating if you would like to see more detailed information, www.iaba.org, where you can see a webpage in which are the full schedule of events, the virtual law review that we publish with respect to Inter-American law, and a lot of other activities that the association is involved in. The IABA was founded in 1940, originally as an association of bar associations throughout the hemisphere. And today it's more than that. Of course, there are many bar associations that are members of the IEBA, but we also have a very, very large number of practicing attorneys from throughout the hemisphere who participate, particularly in our annual conference, which is built around the concept of the members writing papers, usually of an academic nature, presenting them in the forum with respect to the committees under which the IEBA is organized, and then discussion and ultimately publishing of those papers in our law review. As I mentioned, the association is active. Tomorrow, for example, our president, Jorge de Presno, who is the managing partner of the Thompson Knight Office in Mexico City, will be addressing the annual meeting of the international law section of the State Bar of Texas. Next week, we will be co-sponsors of the ICDR 7th Annual Seminar on International Commercial Arbitration, which will be held in Miami, Florida. April 1st through 3rd, we will be co-sponsoring a seminar in San Jose, Costa Rica on human rights in the Americas, followed by our annual conference in the Bahamas, beginning on our committee will meet actually on July 3rd. It's actually a great value and usually have a very fortunate to have a really stellar mix of people who speak at our committee. And with that, I would like to also acknowledge the presence today of Lorena Perez, an attorney with the OAS, responsible basically for arranging and organizing our participation in this event. The other two vice chairs of our committee are Nancy Thevenin with the Baker McKenzie Law Firm and Luis Martinez, vice president with the ICDR. We've been a cooperating institution for the last five seminars that the Washington College of Law has put on the subject of international commercial arbitration. And we'll do so at the sixth annual seminar on international commercial arbitration, How to Handle a BIT, to be held October 13th through 16th here in Washington. And finally, just by way of mention, not something that we're involved with, but we also wanted to give reference to La Primera Competición Internacional de Arbitraje y Derecho Mercantil that will take place in Madrid between the 23rd and 25th of June, sponsored by UNCITRAL and La Universidad Carlos III. This is kind of, I guess you could look at it as a Spanish language vice competition, basically. It's a new competition. This is its first year. For those of you interested in perhaps participating in the future, it would be, I think, a good idea to take a look at that at the website. I won't take up any more time. Thank you once again for this wonderful opportunity, and look forward to working again in the future with the law school. Thank you, Gracia.
Well, without further ado, I would invite the speakers at the first panel on procedural and evidentiary issues in Latin American arbitration cases to come to the podium. And as they come, let me introduce them. The first one, who is just approaching, is Mr. Marcelo Muriel, former partner of Pinheiro Neto in Sao Paulo. For 20 years, he developed a practice in litigation and arbitration with Pinheiro Neto. Among many other things, Mr. Muriel is a chairman of the Arbitration Committee of the Brazilian Bar Association in Sao Paulo. He is an experienced practitioner in the area of arbitration, and now he has his own law firm. Immediately to my right-hand side, Mr. Daniel Gonzalez. Mr. Daniel Gonzalez is also a very distinguished practitioner. He's a partner with Hogan & Harson and the co-directors of the firm's international litigation and arbitration practice. He's based in Miami. His practice essentially covers complex commercial litigation and arbitration in the USA, Latin America, and Europe. And why not Asia as well, Dan? You're not there yet? Okay. I thought you had forgotten that one. We have also a third panel speaker, Mr. Carlos Bianchi. For reasons, possibly some sort of force majeure situation, he hasn't arrived yet. But Mr. Bianchi is an arbitrator and mediator and an international corporate and tax attorney. He has over 25 years of experience, and he has practiced extensively in the USA, Latin America, and Europe. He's based in New York, and he's qualified as a New York attorney. The purpose of this panel, as the title indicates, is to have our speakers share with you their personal experience in respect of procedural matters and in respect of how they view structuring an arbitration in a Latin American context. I'm sure that their interventions will give rise to questions from the floor, so without further ado, I lend them with you, and I would suggest that Dan is the first one to go.
Yeah, they need to bring this back up.
Is it coming?
He had it there, but it just disappeared. Maybe his lectern left on that one. While we're dealing with the technical difficulties, let me thank Washington College of Law for inviting us and Horacio for inviting us to speak on what really is for us a joy to talk about. I mean, we could talk about this all day, but thankfully I was told to be limited to about 10 minutes of remarks, so we will do that. We are going to also try to discuss specifically about Latin America, and in fact, I'll start with talking about Carlos Bianchi, who's not here because that's convenient for me since he was my chairman on a case, which sort of epitomizes the issues, the challenges that we're facing in international arbitration in Latin America. Carlos and I had years ago a case. It was purely in Latin America between two Latin American entities, two different countries in Central America. The arbitration provision was very straightforward, said nothing about what the procedures or the evidentiary procedures of the case would be. And nonetheless, by virtue of the sort of overpowering advocacy of certain lawyers in that arbitration, we found ourselves applying U.S. federal rules of evidence to the case, to the arbitration. And I think that's a good place to start to demonstrate the fact that what is both dynamic, flexible, but also challenging about international arbitration today is the very fact that it really has very little rules. And if I ever get my screen up, I'll show you that in terms of, for example, if you look at the ICC rules, they leave very much in the discretion of the panel, of the tribunal, the determination of how evidence will be taken. And the weight that evidence will be given. If the IBA rules are applied to the arbitration, likewise, they will leave very much discretion to that panel to decide how the arbitration will be conducted. As a consequence, what happens with the arbitration is it's going to be very much determined by the dynamics of the arbitrators, first and foremost, your chairman who is picked on the arbitration, who many times will be determining the procedures and the other arbitrators with their consensus will apply to the arbitration. And then lastly, but like I mentioned in this one example that we had with Carlos Bianchi, very much what happens with the advocates, the lawyers in the case. And so we are many times also our own worst enemies because what many perceive or have perceived in the past as being the advantage of arbitration, the potential for it being easier, quicker, more flexible, many times will get bogged down and will become more challenging over time. Here we go. Oops. I think I need to do this. Hold on. There we go. So the challenge becomes really what are the procedures for an arbitration. And Horacio had the dangerous statement to me last night of saying, go ahead and you can tell war stories. And I thought, you know, rather than telling a lot of war stories, and I'm happy to share some of them with you, I also thought it would be helpful for this group to hear what are parties saying about arbitration. what are our clients, what are the parties to an arbitration that are looking to this arbitration process, what are they sensing, what are they perceiving are the advantages and disadvantages of arbitration. And I'll start first with a very positive message. And this is, by the way, the slides I'm going to be showing you is a collection of statistics, and my colleague here will explain to you later what is good and bad about statistics, but I will share them with you anyway. But I'll start with good news. The good news is, and this is, by the way, this is a series of surveys that were done by PricewaterhouseCoopers in the last couple of years over general counsels of major corporations throughout the world. And this includes Latin America, and I will also have some slides specific to Latin America. But the very good news that you'll see right off the bat is that at least 62% of general counsels will insist on including an arbitration clause in most of their contract deals. And we'll talk about as we go through this why they do that, what's the pros and cons that they perceive about it. And what's fascinating to me is they're not necessarily always the same pros and cons that we as practitioners or arbitrators believe that the arbitration process offers. Now, this slide in terms of statistics will show you what these general counsels are picking in terms of their arbitration process. I'm not sure if I see Luis in the room, but you'll see Luis will be happy to see that he's one of the two organizations. Most arbitrations in terms of general counsel's picking are being picked to be administrated, and therefore also to an extent the procedures that will be applied are under either the ICDR, AAA rules, or the ICC rules. So looking to the ICC rules, what I was alluding to earlier, you can see that it leaves very broad discretion to the arbitration panel as to what are going to be the rules of the game. The tribunal is left with full charge of the hearings to decide totally what will or will not be admitted, how the process will be handled, what rules of evidence or rules of procedures will be followed, and the dirty word, that if you're outside of the United States, by the way, discovery. In fact, we don't use that word. We try not to. We talk about exchange of documents and other things because we all have learned that the word discovery is an ugly North American word. So we try to avoid that. And in Spanish, it doesn't really translate very well anyway. So as you can see, if you look at Article 22, it is up to the tribunal to decide when is it satisfied that the parties have sufficiently presented their case. Now, what does that mean, satisfied? Again, it leaves a lot of discretion. And what the panel, the arbitrators, and the advocates need to understand and appreciate is that very delicate balance between having a case that will be properly presented, and for the same reasons that Horacio was alluding to a minute ago, because at the end of the day, the question will become, is that arbitration award going to be challenged somewhere in the world? And is a court in Latin America, for example, that we're talking about this morning, going to have grounds to challenge because a party did not receive a sufficient opportunity to present their case, present their evidence? And so the challenge that's presented, with very little rules really to follow, is when did you sufficiently do that? And we know, by definition, that one advocate or the other, whoever is on the negative side of that, is going to always argue, I didn't get a fair hearing. I didn't get to present all the evidence I wanted to present. And invariably, one side or the other will want to present additional issues, additional evidence. And so it's up to that tribunal with a very broad discretion to decide when is enough. So let's go back to our general counsels, and what do they think about this? Well, let's go start again with good news. My mother always taught me start with good news, and then we'll go to the bad news. And the good news is they like arbitration. Like I said, 62% are insisting on it, and they're saying they like it because, and the way this bar chart is broken down, the colors might be a little hard to follow. The darkest color is when general counsels were asked, what's the first thing you like most about an advantage of arbitration? That's the dark color. The sort of orangey color, brown, is the second choice, and then the last one is the third choice. And you'll see that the top two answers are flexibility and enforceability. But you can see that also the bar chart is a good sort of bell shape. It's very even across the board in terms of the four different factors they find of flexibility, enforceability, privacy, and selection of arbitrators, the fact that you can select experts and individuals that are perceived to be better than just a randomly selected judge or a jury in the United States system. So those are the advantages. Now let's talk about the disadvantages. And the number one, you can see it's no longer the way the other one was spread out, is it's expensive. And we'll see how expensive it is in a minute. I'll show you a chart. And they know it. They realize it's expensive, and they also believe it's very time-consuming, which ironically, I remember 15 years ago when we were trying to sell our clients on using arbitration clauses, what did we all say? We said, this is a great, less expensive, faster process. Well, it's no longer the case, and it's certainly no longer the case in Latin America. Arbitrations nowadays, I will tell a client that walks in my door for the first day that a typical arbitration of any complex nature you can expect to last from the day that we start that arbitration, which I believe includes also the voir direing of potential arbitrators, an important process of interviewing your arbitrators, which is allowed by all the rules. So beginning from that process to that actual award likely will take you about 2 years. I've had cases that take 1 year. I've had cases that take 5 years. But that's sort of the mainstream of where it's at, and that's not really necessarily any quicker. Some of my former colleagues, partners of mine that are now federal judges, tell me their courts in the U.S. are now running a lot faster. Guess why? A lot of the complex commercial cases that 15 years ago I used to try in a jury in a courtroom are now being done in commercial arbitration. So esteemed arbitrators like Horacio are very busy, and that's the good news. But it's also bogging down the process in terms of the procedures and in terms of the cases, how long they take. So this is the bad news that we're working against and the perception we have. And again, remember, we want that number of 62%, all of us that are practitioners in this area, to keep going up, not going down. And so this is the challenge that we're working against. They also understand that the cost is high. Here is the chart in terms of statistics. Again, this is general counsels around the world reporting on what their companies are paying for major arbitration matters. And you can see that a good share, about 34% of them, are running somewhere between $1 million to over $5 million. Now, you still have a number of smaller arbitrations that are handled that are at the smaller scheme, but the kinds of complex international commercial arbitrations that we're talking about end up in that area there of the pie chart at about 34%. So it is an expensive process, and the general counsels understand that. Now, we go back then to the rules. So with that backdrop, that's the challenge. That's what we need to try to do in terms of our procedures. So we go back to see, well, what guidance do we as arbitrators or as advocates have for an arbitration? And what we see is the IBA rules. And like I mentioned before, it again says that the arbitration tribunal will have complete control. And some clients, I will tell you, are very nervous with that sort of language. I have clients that do not like arbitration precisely because of that language, because they feel that you're giving complete control, and what else is missing from the process? No appeals. So you have complete control on the front end and no appeals on the back end, other than, as Horacio mentioned, the issue of that confirmation of the award and whether countries are going to recognize that award on the back end. Again, Article 9.91 says the arbitral tribunal shall determine the admissibility, relevance, materiality, and weight of the evidence. And so they're given, once again, all of the discretion to decide. And so the case I was mentioning at the beginning with Carlos Bianchi, it was decided by virtue of both parties and the challenge that we were facing, that even though we had a case where the lawyers were not, the lawyers that were front and center were Latin American lawyers, no experience with federal rules of evidence, that was what was submitted to the case, and that was the basis of the hearings. And so we had hearsay objections, which, by the way, in Spanish, it's objeción pruebas de oídos. It doesn't really roll off your tongue. And I will tell you that in that arbitration, I had to adopt my normal style, and when I had the objection to hearsay, I would have to stand up. And so I could think through my head, objeción pruebas de oídos. And the chairman said to me, Mr. Gonzalez, we're not that formal here. You don't have to stand every time. I said, well, no, I'd really rather do that. The real reason I was doing it is I had to think through that objection and give myself time to do it because it didn't roll off your tongue. But it shows you, it demonstrates sort of the application of systems that were really not meant for arbitration and how randomly they're being applied in Latin American arbitrations. Now, why is that happening? Well, this chart, I think, is very telling. This is a chart that's just showing you Latin American arbitrations. Take a look who the lawyers are on these matters. They're not all from Latin America. Our colleague here from Brazil is very well represented. And that, by the way, that 38% is skewed because there's also a very large number currently of arbitrations out of Brazil. So they get a very well represented sample in that. But look at the fact of how many, for Latin American arbitrations, the percentages are U.S. lawyers, Swiss lawyers, French lawyers. It tells you that it's not dominated by Latin American lawyers when you get to international arbitration. And that, as a consequence, I would suggest, is the reason why you're seeing these influences of other systems, of our U.S. Law systems and other systems around the world being tried to be imposed in the process to arbitrators that, as we saw a minute ago, all they have is very general principles that say, you have control, you decide how you want to run the arbitration. The other interesting factor is the industries that are in. And this is, again, a challenge in terms of the procedures and the taking of evidence. Because I recall sitting in Paris at an ICC conference and listening to a very esteemed, now very senior arbitrator that had been doing this for probably 30 years before I even thought about doing international arbitration. And this gentleman said during this presentation, any case that comes before me, any case, I expect the lawyers to submit the case to me with two bundles, and for those of you that don't practice in London, bundles are basically two binders of documents. Any case, didn't matter what case it was. Now the problem with that, of course, that issue is, Horacio and I had a case with 154 claims in a construction case, all of it ranging from the most obscure, irrelevant little issue that never would have been arbitrated but for the fact that by the time we got to the doorstep of Horacio and the arbitrators, nobody would agree to anything, to very complicated, very technical issues of defects on a very expensive project. Explain to me how I take that case and boil it down to two bundles. It's impossible. And so part of the issue and the challenge of these procedures and the taking of evidence that we're talking about is how do you reconcile those two things? And we had to do in that case some very interesting things with using technology and computerized information gathering where we would supply to the arbitrators laptops that had everything in the case all loaded into hyperlinked so they could basically find documents, find video depositions, find video testimony of experts, all of it rolled into one place. And did it work? Did it not work? I don't know. The case ended in a different way. But the fact of the matter is, that's the challenge that we as advocates face, and it's also the challenge that the arbitrators face, because look where the majority in Latin America are the cases. They're in the energy sector, in the construction sector. They're in very complicated sectors that when these cases really are deserving of going, again, remember the expense that we looked at. With the expense associated with arbitration, you're not going to get the simple case going to arbitration. You're going to get these sort of complex cases that it's not simple enough to just put it into two bundles. I put up just for purposes of reference to show you that this phenomenon in Latin America is not true just to Latin America. It's interesting because you'll notice exactly in the same industries that you see in Latin America, the growth of arbitration you see in Europe and the U.S., in the energy, oil, and gas sector, and the construction sector. Those are the sectors. And it's not surprising because it's the sort of infrastructure development, the more complex projects. And my experience with these projects is they either go really well and you never hear about them, or when they go bad, they go really bad. And so you end up with a lot of different claims and issues before an arbitration panel. The contract issues that are being also arbitrated in Latin America are much more complex. You see here, you throw out the others, which is just sort of bits and pieces of different kinds of contracts, but the majority of the contracts are either purchase transactions, construction contracts, M&A transactions. They're complex deals. They're deals where many times the contract documents alone are a couple of bundles, as my esteemed arbitrator requested. So I'm trying to now present those contract issues to a panel along with all of the other evidence and have them understand it. So that's the challenge that we face, and in terms of the procedures that we have, what I put forward to all of you for discussion and to think about as we move forward, and I'm fascinated with this area. I've been practicing. I do this 100% of my time now. My whole team does out of our firm, and what I find most fascinating is it really is the Wild Wild West. It is being created as we speak. Those of you that are here that are still in law school, it's an area of practice that didn't exist when I graduated, and it's an area now where it's really on the cutting edge because it's a new frontier. It's really being created as we see it with the influences of lawyers all around the world bringing to bear their different experiences and backgrounds to the process. And while we're doing that, well, we have to keep in mind that we've got to keep those parties happy. We've got to keep that 62% high or higher than that if we want to make sure that arbitration is the way that we see the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.
morning, everyone. First of all, I'd like to thank Professor Horacio Grijera Naon for this very kind invitation. It's always a pleasure to be here. And I'd also like to thank Daniel for this very interesting statistics. As we were talking about yesterday about statistics, and I say, well, Brazilians don't particularly like statistics. There may be reasons for it, but there was a very famous Brazilian economist and who subsequently became a politician. And he was very respected. And he once said that statistics are not good. Statistics, they are like a Brazilian bikini. It uncovers everything except the essential points. So I hope to give you some sort of a different aspect of how arbitration is currently working in Brazil. As many of you may know, Brazil was a late starter in international commercial arbitration, even in domestic commercial arbitration, even though Brazil had perhaps a long tradition of being involved into international arbitration. Maybe you don't know that Brazil had not one, but two different emperors back in the 19th century. And one of them was a very reputable old man who was appointed as an international arbitration for international disputes between different countries. So it's not entirely fair to say that arbitration is not part of Brazilian tradition, but one must say that definitely international commercial arbitration was far from our day-to-day activities until the mid-90s. The Brazilian arbitration law was actually enacted in 1996, and after enactment of the Brazilian arbitration law, nothing happened for a period of 5 years, because the Supreme Court decided that, well, there may be constitutionality issues here because everyone is involved. Everyone has a guarantee to go to the judiciary. So it took the Supreme Court 5 years to finally render a final ruling by majority vote back in 2001 to confirm that international or commercial arbitration, or arbitration in general, was indeed compatible with the constitutional guarantee of access to the judiciary. And then the next step was taken, that was again 2001, the next step was only taken in around 2002 or 3, when finally Brazil ratified and confirmed the New York Convention. The New York Convention was, is it 1958? So it took Brazil about 50 years to approve it and actually to let it become enforceable in Brazil. So this is just an introductory note for you to have an idea of what I mean by saying that Brazil was a late starter in international arbitration. However, any of you looking at the statistics again of the ICC, they're published on their website, you will see that the number of international or domestic arbitration involving Brazilian companies, Brazilian arbitrators, and Brazilian lawyers is increasing rapidly. Some of the statistics we've just seen would show you that. And it has certainly become a very important way of resolving disputes in Brazil at this point in time. There's a lot going on. There's still a lot of resistance, not on the part of the court system. The judiciary as a whole has been extremely favorable to arbitration in Brazil. But some of the in-house counsels are still reluctant to accept it. Some of the large companies are still very reluctant to accept it too. But things are moving, and things are moving very fast. Now, we're here to talk about production of evidence in international arbitration. And I think that's one of the main topics in which cultural differences and cultural backgrounds will necessarily come to surface. Because, let's be frank, when you look at the IBA rules of evidence, at least that's the Brazilian perspective to the IBA rules of evidence, it was an effort of the international community to find like a common denominator for production of evidence throughout the world so that people would then know how to react and how to produce evidence in arbitration proceedings no matter where. But frankly, the final result, when you look at the IBA rules of evidence, the final result is quite similar to the federal rules of production of evidence here in the U.S. Normally, at least under the Brazilian perspective, anyone talking about the IBA rules of evidence, that is equivalent, that's a synonym to American way of conducting arbitration or court proceedings or anything like that. I know we could argue about that, but that's typically the approach. And why is that? Because the Brazilian way of producing evidence is also entirely different. So if you're looking at, or if you're appearing before a panel with Brazilian arbitrators, you should expect something quite different. The first one is something that I was told in law school dates back to the Middle Ages. It's something that distinguishes, something that distinguishes the Portuguese or the Ibero-American tradition of civil procedure from other countries, which is something called the inquisitorial principle that the judge, or the power that the judge has to actually go after evidence, ask questions, and do whatever has to be done. So it's an entirely different approach that if you're sitting or if you're appearing in an arbitration in which you have like maybe an European arbitrator, and especially German arbitrators or Swiss arbitrators, they'll come to you to say, all right, counselor, I'm here. Bring me the evidence. I'll look at the evidence, I'll examine it, and I'll render a decision. It's entirely up to you as the counsel for the case to produce whatever evidence you want and present it to the arbitration tribunal. That simply doesn't work in Brazil because of this inquisitorial principle that people tend to look at this way of production of evidence as a unilateral way of producing evidence and therefore not subject to adversarial proceedings. And the role performed by the judge or by the arbitrator has to be president all the time throughout the production of evidence so as to ascertain that that evidence is the result of adversarial proceedings and therefore was not simply produced unilaterally by one of the parties. I'll give you examples. I think the most critical example of that will be for technical evidence, like expert witnesses. Sometimes, again, referring to the statistics, sometimes you get very complicated cases like the one I'm handling this very moment, which is a construction case. Very complicated. We're talking about the construction of two hydroelectric plants. Extremely sophisticated, difficult, and so on and so forth. The panel is a typical Brazilian arbitration panel. Three law professors, extremely reputable, learned professors with all the academic credentials you can think of, with no experience whatsoever in the production of evidence in construction arbitration. So you can well imagine how this works or how this does not work, because I am trying to produce evidence, technical evidence, through experts to write reports, to explain about the different aspects of geology or, you know, things, very complicated things, even for someone who's been working on the case for such a long time. And the first reaction for the tribunal was, okay, whatever you have produced through your own experts is considered to be unilaterally produced and therefore has to be reconfirmed. And then I said, by whom? By somebody who's going to be appointed by the tribunal to examine all that. I said, well, good. That's a good starting point, because if the tribunal is going to appoint somebody to examine the reports that have already been produced, and there was a lot of hard work behind that, that would be something good. And then they said, no, that's not how it's going to work. The experts are going to do the same work all over again, because we don't know, you know, how these reports were produced. And then you can well imagine, like, we had to go back in time many months so that the court, well, not the court, but the tribunal-appointed experts would then catch up to the work. And mind you, some of them, then they simply turned out to the tribunal and said, we don't know how to do it, and we don't understand it. So the conduction of the proceedings by this particular tribunal is very typical of Brazil. They don't go into the details. Maybe it's a sort of approach that you can get, like, give me two bundles of documents and that's all I'm going to look at. But don't give me such details. But on the other hand, they refuse to have experts that could do all this, you know, painstaking trouble of going through all the details and checking all the technical aspects. Imagine two hydroelectric plants. It's a lot of work. The other good example that I can give you is about witness depositions. There is a distinction in, I don't know whether it happens in other Latin American countries, but it certainly happens in Brazil. There's a distinction between the deposition of a witness and the deposition of a party. When the party is an individual, that's easy to understand, but when the party is a company, then who is deposing as the company representative? And the expression there is legal representative. Therefore, the legal representative is the individual that the law appoints as the person who represents the company. And there's a lot of discussion to know who that person is going to be. But 10 out of 10 Brazilian arbitration cases would have a controversy normally happening 1 or 2 days prior to the hearing, because in some cases there's very poor planning for the hearing, that who that person is going to be and under what circumstances that person is going to make a deposition. Because if you apply the rules of civil procedure, the company or the party or the company representative is not making a deposition under oath, because it's taken for granted that that's the party speaking, and therefore he doesn't need to necessarily say the truth. I know some of you may think that it's a very different approach, like President Clinton would have perhaps a different court case in Brazil, because normally people would say, well, he is the accused party, he is supposed to lie. And that's, you know, let's take the next step on and see what other witnesses can talk about that. But he is the party. And therefore, he should not necessarily make a deposition under oath. That's one distinction. The second and foremost distinction, and it's a very important one, is the deposition of the party is a way for the other party to produce evidence, not the own party that's producing that deposition. In other words, if I ask for the deposition of the legal representative of the other party, I can only ask questions. And the counsel for the other party only has to sit there and listen. He cannot make questions. So they're not subject to, like, cross-examination or examination indirect, because this would be questions from their own counsel. So that makes a lot of difference. And if those principles that are enshrined in the Brazilian Code of Civil Procedure, when they are applied to domestic arbitration and even to international arbitration with Brazilian arbitrators, will necessarily lead to clashes like the ones we see when we're looking at the IBA rules of evidence. So it's quite obvious. You know, people try to bring the cases back to the way they can understand it and bring the cases back to their own cultural backgrounds. The last comment I'd like to make to you with regard to documentary evidence. There is, I think this is not typical of Brazil, but maybe throughout the world, there is an adverse reaction to anything even similar to discovery of documents. People talk about, you know, fishing expedition. People talk about, you know, endless lists of documents to be exchanged. And in general, what you would see a Brazilian panel of arbitrators do in a case like that is simply reject it. So they would simply say, well, if there is one or two specific documents that you want to look at, all right,
Tell me what they are, and then we'll see what happens. But don't come up with this endless list of all the documents referring or pertaining to any and all documents referring to blah, 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 to such transactions, because that is not going to work. They simply reject that with no further ado. So I've given you, in the 15 minutes of my allotted time, I've tried to give you some touches of cultural differences and of typical approaches that Brazilian arbitrators would take with regard to the production of evidence. Of course, there are many other topics we can talk about. As Daniel said, we can easily talk about this for the rest of the day in case you're interested. But I tried to select just a few just to give you an idea of how things work and how things may not work in Brazil. Thank you very much.
And I call to the podium Mr. Carlos Bianchi, who is now with us. Carlos.
Thank you. I apologize for being late, and I also apologize if anything I say has already been covered by my colleagues. But briefly, when you're talking about procedural and evidentiary issues in Latin American arbitrations, international commercial Latin American arbitrations, we're assuming that either one of the parties is Latin American, or that the arbitration takes place in Latin America, or that the subject matter involves Latin America. Whether serious issues arise depends not so much on where the arbitration is physically held, but on who the counsel are and who the arbitrators are. If you have an arbitration located in a Latin American country with international counsel and experienced international arbitrators, the result is not likely to be very different than if you held it in Miami. But it may be different if the counsel are local counsel, perhaps not so familiar with international arbitration, or one of the or more of the arbitrators are so. And the issues tend to arise when there is a conflict between the Latin American systems and the Anglo-Saxon type system. Again, there tends not to be, serious issues tend not to arise in the case of procedure. In Latin America, as elsewhere, the procedure generally tends to be complaint, answer, motion to dismiss, a period of evidence, and then the rendering of the award or judgment. Where there are maybe serious conflicts, and I heard Marcelo referring to some of them, is in the case of evidence, because there the differences are radical. The counsel may be unfamiliar with cross-examination. Marcelo has just referred to rules on witnesses, that a party in general may not be a witness in his own cause, nor for that matter may be an employee of a corporation, which is a party, or a close relative of one of the parties. Again, I'm talking about generally applicable rules, not necessarily uniform in all of Latin America. Again, Marcelo has referred to documentary evidence. The domestic rules in Latin America may be very restrictive with respect to the production of documents. In general, only originals will be accepted or notarized copies. There may also be differences as to what evidence is relevant. For example, many laws permit moral damages, which is not generally the case in Anglo-Saxon law. There may also be differences as to whether prejudicial evidence may be admitted. Ironically, though in general, the rules of the Latin American systems are more restrictive than what we find here, in some ways they can be more freewheeling. And as an arbitrator, one would often get a request to admit, for example, prejudicial evidence about one party's failure to file his tax returns, which might be admissible in a Latin American jurisdiction but would generally not be in international commercial arbitration. There tend to be, with respect to witnesses, specific rules as to the weight to be given to witnesses. In general, oral evidence, unlike in Anglo-Saxon systems, is given much less weight than documentary evidence. And the counsel may be unfamiliar with the use of witness statements. They may be unfamiliar with the procedure generally followed in international arbitration of using the witness statement as the evidence in chief and then going straight into cross-examination. They may need some education in that regard. Now, having said that, an arbitral tribunal may use the restrictive nature of Latin American procedure and evidence to its advantage. Definitely, the Latin American rules of evidence are restrictive and provide for very short periods in which to give evidence, 3 days, 8 days, 15 days, something totally unfamiliar here. And so a tribunal which is interested in expediting a case may encourage the parties, or if the parties themselves suggest it, may accept that to this extent the rules of evidence be similar to what they would find in their jurisdictions. Very short periods of foregiving evidence, limited puntos de prueba, points of evidence. And so in that respect, a tribunal can use the local rules to their own advantage. Most arbitrations end up procedurally as a mixture, a hybrid between Anglo-Saxon law, civil law, and general international rules. That's true both of Latin American and any other arbitration. Our Bible, the best thing that's ever happened, or one of the best things that's ever happened to international commercial arbitrators are the IBA rules on the taking of evidence in international arbitrations, because that basically can be used as a Bible, and if a tribunal says it's permitted by those rules, 99 times out of 100 it will be accepted. One problem sometimes encountered by tribunals, going on a bit from the strictly procedural and evidentiary aspects, not only in Latin America but elsewhere, is the possibility that a local court may issue an injunction to prevent the arbitration from going forward. And there have been several cases of that nature in Argentina. And Horacio, shall I say a few words about enforcement? Yes. Okay, very briefly, problems about enforcement of foreign arbitral awards, which are characteristic of Latin America, though certainly also to be found in other jurisdictions. Problems still with the survival of the double exequatur rule, that there has to be a judgment rendered in the seat of the arbitration. That we thought had finished, but even as recently as 2003, there was a Chilean case that basically required that. Since then, it's been overruled by the Chilean adoption of the Ancestral Model Law on Commercial Arbitration. Lack of recognition of the principle of the separability of the arbitration clause, of the principle of competens. Several cases, including some in Brazil, where the courts have held that notice is insufficient because they hold that the notice should have been given, service should have been effected in accordance with their local rules and not in accordance with generally accepted rules to be found in the ICC or other rules. Of course, whether the court will re-examine the merits, again, the Brazilian jurisprudence recently has been very consistent in favor of not re-examining the merits, but there are other countries which are not so favorable. We've had some recent cases involving colleagues of ours where there's been a dispute as to the independence or the qualification of the tribunal. The National Grid case in Argentina, the Radio Centro case in Mexico, There are problems with, there may be problems where the arbitration takes place with state entities, which of course have a certain political as well as jurisprudential power in their respective countries. And again, the unruly horse of public policy. It's there in the New York and Panama Conventions, it has to be, but public policy is what you interpret it to be, and some courts, like in the Cartellone case in Argentina, have given probably an unreasonably wide interpretation of what is public policy or contrary to local public policy when it comes to enforcing an arbitral award. Thank you very much.
Well, you have in front of you three different approaches that have raised a number of issues. The floor is open, so we are ready to receive your questions. Yes. I would ask, kindly ask each person putting a question to identify himself or herself and put the question. Marcelo, I see him ready because, and then he has a big construction case, so I'm sure he has been thinking about if he's the claimant.
Yes. Normally, you will need to use the services of technical people, either through depositions, like expert witness depositions, but the approach will always be, typically, a Brazilian arbitrator will look at that. If you're bringing your own expert witness, he'll look and say, "Ah, all right, he was hired by one of the parties." So normally you would get the court or the tribunal to appoint an independent expert to examine and to determine the amount of damages. Of course, in complicated cases like the one I just mentioned, like in construction cases, this is a very difficult exercise because you depend on a group of people to determine each aspect of what's going on. Like, just to give you an example, you can get a geologist to look at the studies and the data available, and then he can say, "Well, all right, I think that there was really a problem, and therefore the problem had repercussions in the construction. But it's not on me to say how much or to calculate, you know, how those damages are going to be." So you need another expert to jump in to say, "All right, taking it from there, let's go into the next step to see if we can calculate and then give the tribunal some idea of how to really determine the amount of damages involved." It's always a very complicated exercise, and of course, the more you can support it with witnesses or with people to provide live testimonies to the tribunal, it's always better, because sometimes the tribunal will not understand written reports, or sometimes the reports will be just too long or too detailed that just don't have the patience or the time to look at. And through a deposition of maybe 5 minutes or 10, you can explain to the tribunal in a much more didactic, is there such a word in English, or
data?
No, a more informative way for the tribunal to understand sometimes a complicated issue. So it's really like complicated, and you will need to resort to each and every different way of producing evidence that you have, and it's normally by putting all things together, like depositions, documents, and especially experts, that you're going to be able to demonstrate the damages.
I assume that when you say depositions you mean expert testimony or fact witness testimony, because in this country depositions
has a very different meaning. So I assume that you're referring to testimony. In front of the tribunal.
Well, yes. The
testimony in front of the tribunal.
In front of the tribunal, oh, that's right.
Okay, thank you.
If I may.
Yes, and if you could add some ingredients about your experience in Latin American cases.
Yeah, absolutely.
Remove the bikini.
Remove the bikini. Your question in Latin America raises a very, very important fundamental issue, because in Latin America what you'll find in many jurisdictions, and going back to the issue, if we're presuming for the moment that the substantive law that applies also is in Latin America, you might find yourself where you have three kinds of elements of damages that you're going to be trying to prove. You might have lucro cesante, your lost profits, daño emergente, you're basically out of pocket or putting you back to where you were before the breach or the event. And as Carlo Bianchi was saying, also you may have daños morales, which is a tortured sort of interpretation or translation of that to our U.S. system, sort of is like a punitive damage, but not really, is the way I would sort of say it. And what's interesting in Latin America is, in the U.S., we're accustomed to the fact that you as a party plaintiff normally would have to choose up front, am I going to proceed under a lost profit theory, meaning I want the benefit of my bargain, or am I going to go under the theory of my reliance damages or my expenses and put me back to where I was before we ever contracted? And under many Latin American countries, you do not need to choose. You can actually argue both and try to claim both. You also then have, in addition to that, the idea of daños morales, which has its roots really in an individual damage to a person, but yet has now been expanded in many jurisdictions in Latin America to also include corporate damages, so that also has an issue. And then you get into other theories of also, if you're dealing with commercial contract issues, whether you also will go even further and claim the loss of value of an entity because of the fact that you breached this contract. It was very fundamental to my business, and therefore now my business is worth X today, which is minus some amount, versus what it would have been worth had you proceeded with the contract as we expected. So that's almost a fourth level of damages. And then the issues of trying to prove that up, I agree with Marcelo, you'll have to determine both in the use of experts, expert reports, and there is where, again, you see cultural differences at play, different legal systems as what will be allowed as to the presentation of those experts. In typical arbitration, we don't allow witnesses to put on direct testimony. Those are usually done by their own affidavits. But yet with the experts, many times arbitrators will allow a little bit more latitude and will allow the experts to put on a short presentation verbally at the hearings of their evidence, precisely because of the reasons Marcelo said, which is that many times the reports themselves are difficult or cumbersome to address. And the last point I'll make is one Marcelo made during his opening remarks, which is very, very controversial both at the arbitrator level and the advocates, is the notion of having a arbitrator-appointed expert versus the party's appointed experts. This is a principle that comes very much in its roots to the civil system and the court systems in Latin America for sure, but one that we find sometimes dangerous, because you get into the notion of, are the arbitrators then really abdicating their responsibility of reviewing the evidence and making the damage calculations and estimations and giving it to yet another layer of experts to decide that and basically rubber stamping what the expert says. So that's always an issue of controversy when you're setting forth the arbitration. The final point to your question then is, these are very important points to try to set out at the very outset of your arbitration in terms of reference as much as you can. Try to get specificity as to what is the expectations of the arbitrators, how will this evidence be presented, and what will be required to prove it up.
I find in practice that this is one area where there is surprisingly little difficulty in getting Latin American parties and their counsel to provide the correct evidence. The concepts which Dan Gonzalez has just described are not that different. You may have to choose, of course, between one measure of damages and the other, but the concept of lucro cesante is very similar to our concept here of lost profits, daño emergente, which is direct damages, plus even the concept of foreseeability and non-foreseeability are there in the Latin American codes, directo and indirecto. In my experience, the only areas where there are major differences are Danius Morales, which we've already discussed, and also penalty clauses, which are legal under Latin American civil codes, unlike in the United States.
Following up on that question, have you been ever exposed in a Latin American context to a loss of chance compensation claim, which is normally accepted in many civil codes in Latin America? Have you ever? If no, yes or no? Yes.
I faced that allegation coming from the other party in an arbitration. And
under which law?
Under Brazilian law. And, well, it was rejected by the tribunal. I was,
so you don't complain.
I have nothing to complain about that. But it was actually, it was clear that it wasn't properly constructed as an argument and as a claim. It was just something that was thrown out at the very last minute to say, well, by the way, you know, I lost some business opportunities, and there was not sufficient evidence, again, of, you know, what those business opportunities were and what sort of a loss would be resulting from that. So it was simply, it's not that it was ignored by the tribunal, but it was, of course, rejected by the tribunal.
Thank you. Questions? Yes. Could you speak more loudly, please, Emilia? It doesn't work? So they want to speak more loudly.
Maybe. It doesn't matter.
It's working now.
No, my question for you is, how do you take into context public policy, particularly in situation of rapidly changing political circumstances? In Latin America, we can think, just to make some examples, of Venezuela, Bolivia, Argentina, all sorts of disputes, let's say gas leases in Bolivia, in Ecuador maybe oil, in Argentina exporting meat and having to pay more taxes. How do you take that into account when at times arbitration seems to emphasize a capitalistic view, let's say, of contracts, profits, reliance, and then you have public policy come in and trump all of that? How do you adapt, don't lose your credibility, and in the end solve the problem?
Shall I start again?
And maybe you can put also that in the context of public policy and procedure, maybe, in general statement.
Well, public policy is something, again, we could talk about for hours. But I think public policy is the last threshold of the, sometimes when you look at the national sovereignty of different countries, especially like in Latin America. And you will have, like Horacio just mentioned, you will have specifically important repercussions as far as procedural rules are concerned regarding public policy. Daniel referred to, and Carlos referred to, some Brazilian Supreme Court precedents rejecting the enforceability of foreign arbitral awards because of defective service of process on the Brazilian party. That is considered to be a public policy issue. There are dozens of reiterated decisions by the Brazilian Supreme Court that if a Brazilian party is not properly served with process, then that will be a procedural aspect that will make it impossible for the enforcement of the arbitral award to be rendered. So that is a very good example. Of course, there are other situations in which you come across public policy issues, and that will have to be decided on a case-by-case basis. I had a big case that became very famous, in which there were lots of discussions about public policy. That was a case in which a state-owned company had entered into an arbitration agreement or a contract with an arbitration clause, and there were lots of public policy issues to be discussed there. Generally, the tribunal rejected all of those in one way that when you read between the lines, what the decision is telling you is
In international commercial arbitration, you are far above and beyond those rules of public policy for each individual country. I know there are people that even go one step further to talk about transnational public policy rules and what would be the common denominator of principles in several different jurisdictions. But of course, it's always very difficult for you to draw the line and to say, well, this is black and white. Like, if you look at some of the countries, like if you look at a country that's officially a Muslim country, that places an advertisement to say, we are hiring engineers to work in our plants, provided that they are Muslims. They have reasons to do that, but that would be considered utterly incompatible with the Brazilian Constitution, for instance, so, because no one can be discriminated on the basis of religion in Brazil. So if I am a Catholic and I would be applying for that job, I would say, you cannot say that you're only hiring Muslim engineers. I can apply for the job, and that's a guarantee in the Constitution. So it's always difficult to say, is that a public policy issue? Where do you draw the line? There are reasons for, like, a company or a country to place an advertisement like that. But if I'm going to examine that under my perspectives or under my principles of public policy, you may have clashes.
We have time for one or two more short comments on that question, and unfortunately we'll have to wrap up because we're a little bit behind time.
Real quick, I'll just make one comment, because I think in answer to your question directly about what to do about that, how to anticipate it, I think what I would say as both either an advocate or as an arbitrator is you have to then fairly try to anticipate some of those public policy issues, because it is true, as Marcelo says, you can't anticipate them all. But as the issues come up during the arbitration process, try to fairly adjust, even though the arbitrators will say, well, I'm not bound by those local procedures. You really want, as both the arbitrator and even I as the advocate, even if I'm on the defending side, I may win the battle but lose the war if the arbitrators agree with me and don't apply those procedures. But then 2 years later, I find myself, I can't confirm that award because that public policy issue is going to come back to bite me. And so I'll give you one quick example. We had a case in Switzerland, and the arbitration clause said Bern procedural rules will apply. Well, Bern procedural rules in Switzerland say that it is unlawful and criminal for parties to interview witnesses before a hearing. That obviously made it totally impalpable to have an arbitration hearing. And what we did is up front get both parties to agree with the arbitrators that those procedures would be set aside and had that documented in the process so that later that could not come back to hurt us when that award would be issued and someone would say, ah, this is against public policy of the venue because of these procedures were not followed. So that's the only way you can try to attempt to anticipate as much as possible those issues.
Very, very briefly.
Yes, sure. Well, Dan has stated it from the point of view of counsel and very correctly stated it. I'll state it from the point of view of the unfortunate arbitrators. We are regularly besieged by statements by counsel saying, if you do not do what we say, this will be against public policy in the country of enforcement. Now, we are in a bind there. On the one hand, we don't believe that it's relevant to the arbitration. On the other hand, we should, if possible, consistent with our brief, render an award which is enforceable. So we, as arbitrators, sitting on the other side of the table from Dan, do listen to such arguments and do, if possible, try to make our award as consistent as possible with local public policy.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, unfortunately, our time is out. I would have liked to ask Marcelo why the IBA rules are like the federal rules of procedure as to evidence. That would give rise to maybe one more hour of discussion. I have my doubts about that statement. But in any case, thank you very much. Let's give a hand to this panel. Unfortunately, we only have 5 minutes for a pause, and then please get back in 5 minutes for the next panel. Thank you.